Call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development to order for Monday, February 4th, 2019. And I'm going to open an informational hearing on alcohol regulations. So committee members, we currently have 6 bills assigned to us having to do with beer, cider, wine, or distilled spirits. What a list, huh? Today, we are combining an overview of alcohol regulation from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission with a public hearing following this on one of those bills. So if the representative from OLCC will please come forward and identify yourself for the record. So this is the other part. We heard about cannabis before. Now it's the liquor, distilled spirits, beer, cider, and wine. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the OLCC, and I have with me today Bill Schutte, he's our Chief Financial Officer, and Kelly Rout, our Director of Administrative Policy and Procedures. Before we get started today, I just wanted to provide just a little bit of context. Last week, you heard about our marijuana program. And this week, we're going to be talking, today, we're going to be talking about an alcohol program. But in reality, in the agency, those two programs are integrated. While we have dedicated alcohol staff and dedicated marijuana staff, our management of those programs, our managers manage both alcohol and marijuana. For instance, Rich Evans, our Director of Public Safety, is in charge of licensing and compliance for both alcohol and marijuana. This, just to provide a little context, when our director, Steve Marks, talked last week, he talked about when Measure 91 came into effect legalizing marijuana. And one of the important things that I don't think people realized at that time is we didn't have any staff or any money. The legislature hadn't met yet. And so it was all hands on deck. Our alcohol staff got in and continually worked on, before we got our staff here, to how do we prop up the system and keep it going while we're waiting for the legislative process. Now we're in a position where we have a program that's working. We may have some warts and bumps in marijuana programs, but largely that program is whole. And so our alcohol folks have been able to go back and look at what do we need to do in alcohol policy? What do we need to do with our IT systems? And refocus. So while we're still building the marijuana program, we're taking fresh look at the alcohol program as well. It's also important to realize that while our agency has been in existence since 1933, talk a little bit about that history here, we're actually a relatively young agency. And it's because two-thirds, when we first started before marijuana, we had 230 employees. Now we have 326. And two-thirds of our employees are either new to the agency or new to their positions within the agency. What's that? The good part of that is that we have a real, still a solid core of folks with a long history at the agency that can inform us as we move forward in both alcohol and marijuana. But we also have an influx of fresh ideas. And it's an exciting time to work at the agency. As I said before, we've had some growing pains. We're going to continue to have growing pains. But it gives us an opportunity to look at things differently and to move forward. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit about the history, just a quick snippet on the history of alcohol in Oregon, our responsibilities relating to alcohol, how beer and wine are regulated differently than distilled spirits, the types of licenses we regulate, our alcohol revenues. We're going to talk about agent compensation and retail store expansion, how the distilled spirits and shipping process works, and key issues for the agency moving forward. So we have a kind of a jam-packed agenda, but we'll get through it and be ready to answer your questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kelly Rout. I'm the director of the Administrative Policy and Process Division at the OLCC. So like Renee said, I'm going to start off with some history. So starting with 1844, the Oregon Territory passed the first prohibition law in the United States, although they repealed that a year later and leaving that authority to the local ordinances to ban liquor sales. And then in 1915, Oregonians again banned liquor sales ahead of national prohibition, 4 years ahead of national prohibition, which was implemented in 1919. The Noble Experiment, as it was called, was carried on for 14 years and then was repealed in 1933 with the 21st Amendment of the Constitution. The Oregon Legislature convened a special session just 4 days after the repeal of national prohibition, and that's when the OLCC was created. That was created in order to provide the state with needed revenue and then to keep alcohol abuse as low a level as possible. So, OLCC has been regulating alcohol for the past 86 years, and through over those years, we have been adopting and amending our administrative rules to change with the times. A lot of those changes guide production and sales of alcohol in Oregon, focus on public safety, namely preventing alcohol to get into the hands of minors, and then adapting to business practices. I think Oregon businesses are very innovative and creative, and so we have tried to adapt with those changes. The regulation of alcohol in Oregon has many facets, and the types of things that we do at the OLCC are licensing businesses that manufacture, distribute, and sell alcohol to consumers. We issue permits to the people that actually serve that alcohol at restaurants. They are trained and required to be trained. We manage and distribute the distilled spirits in Oregon. We regulate all licensed businesses that sell and serve alcohol through education, inspections, and compliance follow-up or complaint follow-ups. We provide public information about the responsible use of alcohol. We collect taxes for beer and wine. And then we have an administrative hearings unit that provides due process to those we regulate for violations and if we are proposing to refuse a license or a permit. The supply chain for alcohol follows what we call a three-tier system, and this is in place in much of the United States. The top tier are those entities who make the alcohol. We call them manufacturers, and those license types could be breweries, brew pubs, wineries, and distilleries. The next tier are those entities who distribute alcohol and store alcohol. They distribute that alcohol usually between manufacturers and retailers, or that alcohol will be leaving the state or coming into the state. Those are distributors and warehouse licenses. And then finally, we have the entities who sell to consumers, and those are retailers. And retail licensees fall into two camps, on-premises sales or on-premises consumption, bars and restaurants where alcohol is sold by the drink, and off-premises sales, which is to-go sales, and those are alcohol that's sold at grocery and convenience stores. What supports the three-tier system in Oregon is a set of laws that we call Tied House Laws. Tied House Laws is a specific term of art of British origin that's used in both federal and state law. And the general rule of these Tied House Laws is that entities are prohibited from having an interest in both a manufacturer, a wholesaler, and a retailer. There's sort of a line in the sand between suppliers, manufacturers and wholesalers, and retailers. In order to, suppliers can't be tied to retailers through financial interests or creating incentives that could exert undue influence on the products that retailers want to sell or the choices that consumers have. But there are exceptions to this, obviously. You've probably seen places in Oregon where alcohol is being made at a brew pub or a winery, and they might actually be distributing alcohol directly to a retailer, and they might actually be tasting alcohol at their locations and you know, selling alcohol for the drink at their location and also selling to go. Well, how can that be? Well, that's because of some of our exceptions to the Tide House laws. If there is a specific grant in the license privilege statute that allows for both wholesale and retail sales, then that is not a violation of our Tide House laws. So over the years, a lot of our license privilege have been changed to allow these manufacturers to have some retail privileges. And so that's why you see a lot of craft industry sort of doing all of it at once. Once licensed, wholesalers and manufacturers are prohibited from providing financial assistance to retailers. That's also called trade practices at the federal level, again, to prevent undue influence to retailers and either underwriting their business expenses or making decisions for retailers. The types of financial assistance that we regulate is extending credit to retailers or volume discounts or providing certain items or services of value. Of course, there are some exceptions to that in our regulations.
Representative McClain, excuse me.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I mean, I'm trying to make sense of that. If you know, if you make exceptions to a rule, then it kind of brings into consideration what's the basic philosophy. You said undue influence, but it seems as if the way you just described the exceptions, that you can have the ability to be financially connected and at all.
Thank you, Chair Lively, Representative McClain. That's a good question. It's one that we get sometimes, and I will say that the Tide House laws are they're a sort of a complicated area of alcohol regulations. they take a while to discuss, but so the undue influence is on like one manufacturer to non-connected retailers. So we have allowed, well, the legislature has allowed exceptions to the Tide House laws through statutes, so that a brewpub or a winery, for example, can sell their own the products that they manufacture at retail.
Well, monopoly is what comes to mind, Mr. Chair. What are you afraid of, a monopoly?
Chair Lively, Representative McClain, not this is within beer and wine, no, because there are so many different competitors in the market that there isn't any one that has taken over. Each licensee has the ability to decide where those products are sold. And so there is a fair amount of competition in the beer and wine space.
Get it. Okay.
Okay. And just, it's worth noting that last week you heard a presentation on marijuana regulation. The regulations surrounding Tide House laws for marijuana and alcohol are very different in marijuana. We do allow for vertical integration, and there are no Tide House prohibitions. These were regulations that were passed after the repeal of prohibition. There was a very large concern that large manufacturers could exert undue influence over alcohol manufacturers at that time. And as I've mentioned, over time, I think there's been a lot more competition, and the concern is much less, but the regulations remain. Beer and wine and distilled spirits are regulated differently in Oregon, and that decision was made after the repeal of prohibition. Some states, such as Oregon, have decided to retain some aspect of control over all or part of the supply chain. In Oregon, we have maintained control over distilled spirits. In other states, there's control over all alcohol types, or just wine, or just distilled spirits. They kind of take different flavors, and there's 17 states throughout the U.S. that currently have some level of control, like Oregon. Beer and wine are sold through our alcohol-licensed entities, and distilled spirits are sold through our state-controlled system. And for distilled spirits, the manufacturer will own the product until that product is shipped to stores. The flow of distilled spirits in Oregon will be covered later on in this presentation. In our licensing system, that's where we issue licenses to anyone who wants to manufacture, distribute, or sell to consumers. So we issue all of the licenses to distilleries, to wineries, to grocery stores, that sort of thing. And we will work with licensees to improve and modernize their business practices through our rulemaking and then legislative process. Some examples of how we've done that over the last few years are on the next slide. OLCC wants businesses to be successful and have worked with them over the years to allow for innovation while still balancing public safety and responsible use. The items on this list can be broken into three categories. One would be customer convenience for access to distilled spirits. Another is increased increase access to where you can purchase or consume alcohol, and then finally repealing some outdated regulations. So in the first category, some of those things that come to mind are Sunday and holiday sales. They are allowed in Oregon. There are still places in the U.S. where Sunday sales are prohibited. We allow those sales, and it's up to the individual liquor agent to decide whether they want to be open on those days. We do allow for licensed distilleries to obtain a license to have a tasting room so they can have customers come in and see how the alcohol is made, but then also try some of the product. And then if they have a liquor agent contract, can also purchase a bottle from that location. We also allow for tastings at liquor stores. So if you go into a liquor store and there are new products, there might be a representative from a manufacturer that is tasting distilled spirits. And then you can also purchase distilled spirits at the airport. As far as places where you can purchase or consume alcohol that are somewhat unique in Oregon, movie theaters. You can purchase alcohol at movie theaters, and we do require, when we license them, to have a minor control plan in place to make sure that alcohol isn't getting to minors, as well as food carts. A lot of cities have food cart pods, and we do allow for some alcohol to be sold there, subject to a control plan. And then farmers markets. There's a big craft industry here in Oregon, and we do issue temporary special event licenses to manufacturers to be able to showcase their product at a farmers market when that is operating and provide tastes and sell that alcohol to go. And then finally, some of the restrictions that we have eliminated in the past few years because they are somewhat outdated could be what's called here the happy hour rule. That's what the industry calls it. It's our advertising restrictions. They were somewhat restrictive in that it was prohibited for advertising your discounts on alcohol. But there were so many other places where you could find that information, whether it was through a media company or through an online review website, that there really wasn't a reason to keep that restriction in place. And then also tap labeling restrictions. We had a very old regulation that required for draft systems every tap to be labeled with the product. But if you've been to a lot of premises these days, they do a lot of rotating taps and seasonal and limited items. So it makes a lot more sense to just put that information on the chalkboard or a computer screen. So we eliminated that requirement to actually have a tap labeled for each product. And with that, I will hand it over to Bill.
Thank you. For the record, Bill Schutte, Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm going to run through some of the numbers, some of the revenues that the agency deals with. Kelly just gave you a description of the license types, but I thought I'd give you a little bit of scale. So right now we have almost over 14,000 liquor licenses within the state of Oregon itself. Those are in-state licenses. About half of those are what we call on-premises licenses, which are basically bars and restaurants. Another almost 5,000 off-premise licenses. Those are grocery stores, convenience stores that sell beer and wine. There is a high number of winery licenses, over 1,000. That doesn't mean there are 1,000 wineries in the state of Oregon. Anytime a winery needs a secondary location, such as a storage facility or an additional tasting room or something like that, they have to go and get an additional license. One of the fastest growing segments that we've seen over the last 10 years have been breweries and brew pubs. And then almost 200 what we call distributors. So a lot of the beer and wine, as Kelly mentioned, have to go through a middle tier, the distributors, and that's who handles that. And then about 114 Oregon distilleries. In addition to that, we have issue about 9,000 a year special event licenses. Those are one day event licenses or certificates that if somebody wants to have a special event like a food festival or a concert or something of that nature, we issue those. All over the state. There are almost 3,000 out-of-state certifications, so those that ship alcohol into the state, such as wineries and breweries and even distilleries, get these out-of-state certificates. And then, as Kelly mentioned, we have a system where those that work in bars and restaurants are required to have an alcohol service permit, take a test, get a certification. We have almost 166,000 of those. What you're seeing next is a schedule of the actual licenses. You may be seeing some legislation that will look at the license fees. On an average, our license fees are very low. A lot of them have not been changed since at least the 1940s, according to our records. But they are annual licenses. They're paid by each licensee on an annual basis. a little bit about alcohol revenues. So when you talk about OLCC, a lot of times they'll talk about the revenues. So the gross alcohol sales over the state this biennium are forecasted to be $1.41 billion, a biennium over a two-year period. In addition to that, we collect fees from those liquor licenses. About $12.7 million are expected. And about, we also collect a beer and wine tax of about $38 million. One thing about alcohol revenues is that they do continue to grow. On average, distilled spirits sales do grow on an average of about 5% per year. One of the questions that's come up to me is how do marijuana sales compare to alcohol sales? This year, for example, in 2018, we recorded about $654 million in alcohol sales. And I think total marijuana sales was $634 million. So it's not quite up to the level of spirit sales, but marijuana sales are growing at a faster rate than spirit sales.
Rep. Sam McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I'm looking at the pie chart one slide back, and I'm surprised by that. I didn't realize that the distilled spirit portion of this revenue so outweighed everything else. Yes. Is that because of national sales from our distillers in Oregon? I mean, how do you compare those two? You may be breaking it down more in your presentation, but I'm just surprised by the differential.
Representative McEwen.
McEwen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So distilled spirits is a business, so those are the gross sales. One of the reasons for the discrepancy is on beer and wine tax. That is a tax on gross sales or tax on volume. So, but for as far as the volume and revenues that the agency picks, we are more into the distilled spirits than we are onto the wine and beer and licensing fees.
Follow up?
Certainly, go ahead.
Is this just because of the evolution of the last 100 years and that the brewery wine business is newer and this the distilled spirits is more mature? I'm just trying to get a sense of this differential here because we sell a lot of beer and wine in this state.
Yeah, Representative, that is correct. But also keep in mind, and we'll talk about the beer and wine taxes a little bit later on, but the beer and wine taxes are relatively low relative to the rest of the country as well.
Representative Fahey.
I think it's just, so I was confused by it too, but because we operate, it's all the revenue. So if a bottle of vodka costs $50, that whole $50 is included in the distilled spirit sales, whereas it's just the tax for beer and wine.
Not tax. Thank you. Sort of a weird apples and oranges chart. Thank you.
How the distilled spirits are broken down a little bit later.
Okay.
It's still the profit margins and how much the agency costs.
Representative Fahey, thank you. That was very helpful.
Oh, because we sell it.
This is sales.
Yeah.
This is tax.
This is sold at our stores.
Whoa.
Exactly.
We're making a lot of
it doesn't seem like it.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
New revenue stream.
Still, spirit sales do grow on average of about 5% per year. You'll see in this biennium, you'll see two dots up there. $1.31 billion was the agency's forecast. But then on the legislatively approved budget, they added 3% to that related to our recent expansion of liquor stores. I can tell you right now, we're probably getting closer to that $1.3 billion. We're not seeing the bump that the legislature anticipated, but we are starting to see some increase related to the expansion of liquor sales. How is revenue distributed? This is a monthly process, so the revenue comes into the agency, we record it, we take out our expenditures, and then we distribute it on a monthly basis, but on a biennial basis, about 56% of that goes to the general fund. These are all statutorily defined formulas for distribution of revenue. Let's share to cities and counties, mental health. 2 cents of every gallon for wine is distributed to the Oregon Wine Board. And so we are the third largest revenue source for the general fund and the second largest often for cities and counties. Uh, A little bit about beer and wine tax collection. Oregon has established what they call excise taxes for beer and wine. Many other states have a similar system. Currently, that's about 8 cents per gallon for beer and 67 cents per gallon for a table wine and 70 cents per gallon for dessert wines. Beer and wine taxes are generally collected at the wholesale tier. So as beer and wine is brought into the state, they're collected from those distributors, the 200 plus distributors that I alluded to before. Taxes are paid though by Oregon wineries and also by Oregon breweries and brew pubs. So the distilled spirits model. This is kind of an overall breakdown of how that model is. Those gross sales that I was talking about before, that would be the equivalent of that $17 a bottle, so that's the total. But of that $17 a bottle, 49% or about half of that is the manufacturer's cost, so that's what we have to pay back to the manufacturers for the cost of goods sold. 1% goes into credit card fees. The state does pick up all credit card fees for liquor sales in the state of Oregon right now. And then 4% goes for the total OLCC operating expense, which does include public safety. So in reality, we remit about a 37% net profit to the state on a monthly basis.
So I see the 8.93% Liquor Store Operators Commission. So that's a fixed amount just based on their gross sales?
Or? Yeah. Chair Lively, that is a fixed amount, but is an average amount. So okay. I'll get a little bit about how our liquor store agents are compensated. It's a rather complicated formula, but basically they get a percentage for their consumer sales, they get a percentage for their sales to bars and restaurants, but they also get a base compensation rate. Okay. But we have to hit that 8.93%, and that's a legislative mandate.
Thank you. 8%. Representative McEwen.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, how long has it been since that has been adjusted, the operator commission?
The operational, the 4%?
The 8.93 liquor store operator commission.
The 8.93 was adjusted, I think, two biennia ago when the liquor store agents got a little bump with referred mostly to their conversion of stores from what they call exclusive, non-exclusive.
Okay, thank you.
So what was it, 8.88%?
For the record, I'm Renee Niedermeyer again, and I'm gonna go through the distilled spirits distribution process in Oregon. Distilled liquor comes into Oregon in three different ways. They either come from brokers, or they come from manufacturers or distillers. They, in order to be sold in Oregon, they need to be listed by our commission. We have about 4,500 products, different products that are listed. We carry about 2,000 of those in our warehouse, and 2,500 of them can be special ordered. We also do some trial listings and some seasonal listings, so we're continually adjusting our product mix to meet consumer demand. We have one main distribution. We actually have two buildings, but one main distribution center in Milwaukee. It's vendor managed inventory. They watch their, we also watch it, but they watch it. They actually own the inventory in our warehouse until we ship it out to liquor stores. So we have, if you haven't had a chance, we'd love to give you a tour. We have these two huge warehouses. We have a complete turn of inventory 10 times a year, and our average retail value of the liquor is stored in those buildings are $90 million. So that we have, as you've heard, we have private liquor agents, and these agents choose what's sold in their stores. However, we work with them. We have district managers who work with them to identify which products are selling in other areas, maybe changing, you know, having discussions about possibly changing product mixes and displays. We can split cases. In some cases, that's really important for small rural stores. We can, as we talked about before, order some special products. Average retail value of the liquor that's in the stores themselves for each store is $235,000, but we have some stores that have over $1 million worth of inventory in those stores. The state owns the inventory in the stores, that is not purchased by the retail agent, but they get a commission, which we'll talk about a little bit more. The total retail value in all the stores in Oregon is $59 million. So OLCC partners with private carriers to distribute the alcohol all over the state. We pay for the shipping. Some, they're very, very busy. It's rare, but the very busy stores can get up to 3 shipments a week. Most of our stores are, you know, somewhere around 1, maybe 2 shipments a week. But particularly out in rural Oregon, those are generally all batched together, and they're shipped once a week. And when they are shipped out our door, and I think that's important, the legislature did a really great thing for us by funding extra conveyors and software to get this product shipped out the door. We have 6.9 million cases of alcohol that goes out of our warehouse in a biennium, and it used to all have to go out one door, one conveyor, one door. Now we're shipping out of 4 doors, and we're saving some, we're getting our shipments done quicker, and it's working really, really well for us. But when it goes out the door, it's ordered and it goes out the door, that's when we pay the manufacturer for the product. At the liquor store, the product is sold, they're either sold to consumers or licensees. Licensees get a 5% discount on the sale, but the liquor store gets the full commission for the retail price for that bottle. And manufacturers can provide some promotional material, some marketing support. For instance, Kelly mentioned they could provide tastings in the stores. And then we have district managers, who I mentioned before, who offer support and watch the sales in each of the stores and provide expertise. The spirit sales are tracked daily, and our commissions to liquor agents are paid monthly, and also our base compensation. And Bill will be going through that a little bit more.
The comment that, and maybe I just missed this, you made the comment that, quote, this, once the liquor ships from the warehouse, then the state owns the liquor while it's in the establishments. So does that mean we pay, we the state pay the manufacturer, the distributor, wholesaler at that time?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, that is correct. So soon as is while the distilled liquor is in the warehouse, the manufacturer owns it. As soon as it goes out of our warehouse, then we pay the manufacturer, and we own the liquor, distilled liquor that is in the liquor stores throughout the state.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you limit them on how much they can store at your warehouse, or can they store all their stock there as far as how fast you distribute it?
Chair Lively, representatives, yes, we do. We work very closely. Warehouse space is very, very important for us. It's expensive, and we have like minimums and maximums.
Okay.
Thank you.
So again, Bill Schutte, Chief Financial Officer for Liquor Commission. A little bit about our liquor stores, our retail liquor agents. The commission selects the retail liquor agents. Retail liquor stores will come in, they'll come out, they'll retire. I'll talk a little bit about expansion. They operate on contracts. We dictate the contract and the operational requirements. As far as compensation, each liquor store does get a base compensation, a fixed amount per month. And that will vary depending on their level of sales. In addition to that, they will get variable rates, including on average about 6.5% for licensee sales or sales to bars and restaurants, and a little over 8% for consumer sales. Again, we have to tweak those rates occasionally to get to that average of 8.93%, but that's basically, you know, how our agents are compensated. CC does pay for the shipping and delivery costs from the warehouse to the liquor stores, and OLCC prints labels and provides training and agent support. The agents themselves are required to build, maintain, and rent the buildings, purchase the fixtures, hire staff and train, basically sell the liquor, order and receive stock inventory, employ payroll taxes. On occasion, as agents do retire, we do calculate what they call a retirement benefit. So they do get a little bit out of their business paid by the oncoming agent as they come in.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you. Thank you for indulging me, Chair Lively. I have one other question. I think I want to go back one slide. So when you mentioned that the manufacturer gets paid when the liquor goes out the door, I know we've had some instances where we have small distilleries who are far from your warehouse and shipping a case to the warehouse and then back was creating some issues with our small distillers. And I know you work very hard to address that. How does that work in your description of how that manufacturer then gets paid? And I know it took some effort on your part, and I'm grateful to solve that problem. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely, Chair Lively, Representative. That was an interesting process for us because distilleries are treated just a little bit differently. However, what we tried to do was figure out a way that we wouldn't have that situation where a small distillery tasting room needed to ship a whole case to OLCC and then we'd ship it back to the bar right down the street. And so what we did is we developed an electronic way. First of all, let me just talk about distillers in general. Distillers are compensated just a little differently. And so the way that it works for distillers is that they own the inventory in their distillery tasting rooms because, after all, they are a manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So they own that inventory. But the minute we sell, 30 seconds before they sell it to the to the consumer, we own it. And that's how we get past the OLCC owns and sells all the liquor in the state. So we own that inventory. They sell it to the consumer. Then what they do, rather than reporting their sales daily and getting a commission monthly, they actually remit to the state the state's markup, so the 37% Bill had referred to earlier.
Chair Lively, I just want to give a lot of credit to the OLCC. That we had a problem in my district with a very small distiller. And they came down, they sat down with him, tried to problem solve, and they actually did solve the problem for this very small business. And I really appreciate the work that went into that and to Director Marks and those who tried to figure out a creative way to solve a problem for small businesses across the state. And you were a let's get it done and see if we can solve it kind of an attitude when you came in. And it was really greatly appreciated, but I never quite understood exactly how you managed that and still got your cut, even though the case wasn't going to Portland and back, which didn't make any sense for anybody. But you did a wonderful job, and it was appreciated.
Okay, thank you very much.
A little bit more about how retail liquor sales agents, and it also includes the distillery agents, they are selected by the retail, by the commission itself. There's an open process for that. It's one of those where, if you come in the commission meeting, a lot of the time the commission is spent up by selection of new retail liquor store agents. And how are they selected? We often will look at their business proposal, capital investment and financing, retailer business experience, knowledge of the alcohol industry. We are cognizant on the impact on nearby agents. We want to know how close they are and what that could be and how this adds to the convenience of liquor store sales. We also look for estimates of sales and revenue from these new stores as well.
Maybe you'll talk about this, but is there in that location, and this goes way back when I was on city councils and that talking about this, so is there also some restriction to concentration or the number of stores that can be located in any, I'm trying to go back to, I mean, you can't have next door appreciation to them, but the total number in any community, is there some constant rules about the concentration of the total number can be in any community?
Chair Lively, at this point, no, there is not.
Okay. So Chair Lively, I also wanted to add to that just a little bit. Some local governments have restrictions on bars and restaurants and locations there, but not on liquor stores. However, I can say that our commission is very careful about not siding stores on top of each other. We're looking, when we do retail expansion, we're looking for areas that are underserved or you know, don't have necessarily another liquor store close by. So that's one of the criteria we look at.
So I guess, just to follow up that, so if we're, I'm trying to understand what drives, so does it, is it driven by, because you talked about one of those earlier slides about what the projections were for new locations, and it's probably not going to be that high. So I'm trying to still understand, so what in the market shifts or changes that would even indicate that there might be a need for another location?
Chair Lively, I'll talk a little bit about that on expansion. About 2.5 years ago, the agency made a decision with the Executive Director Marks and the commissioners that at one point, you know, the growth of new liquor stores had really stopped in the state. So we started a new program, and I'll talk a little bit about expansion and how that's worked out, where we started a process of recruiting for new liquor stores, again, cognizant of the impact on existing agents and where those were located as well. But basically, it was to get from a ratio back in the 80s where we started was about one liquor store per 12,000. Mm-hmm. That had grown to about one liquor store per 16,000 in the last year, couple years. And so we were trying to expand the number of stores to get back to that 1 to 12,000 ratio, which was really the ratio of when the stores were operated by state employees.
Okay, thank you.
Again, a hard map to read, but it shows the concentration of liquor stores through the state. As I mentioned, about 2.5 years ago, we started an expansion program. We started with almost 248 liquor stores at that time. Currently, with the expansion program, we're up to 284 approved locations. 77 of those are what they call exclusive stores. Those are stores primarily in metropolitan areas that sell just liquor with some related items. But a larger number of those are about 199 are what we call non-exclusive stores. They could be a store that is partnered with a convenience store or a gas station in rural areas of Oregon. But in some of the larger areas now, there are stores that are also selling beer and wine as well as distilled spirits, another revenue source for them. In addition, we have about 98 what they call distillery agents. Oregon distilleries can apply for the privilege and ability to sell their own liquor out of their own distilleries or some auxiliary locations that they designate. There are about 98 of those in the state now. So a little bit about retail expansion. It was the largest retail liquor expansion in Oregon. We've added about 36 stores since about the last 2.5 years. Adding multiple new stores and phases throughout the state, and I'll show a map of where those phases occurred. The objective was to improve customer convenience by adding additional liquor locations with a measured but a consistent approach to growth. Open a variety of different business models where customers can purchase spirits, that it could include the addition of spirits to another business, as I mentioned, non-exclusive model, or it could be a traditional liquor store, it could be a boutique store in a retail location. About 30 years ago, as I mentioned, the ratio was one store per 12,000 residents. That was when the state stores were operated by state employees. That had grown to about one store per 16,000. We have not completed our expansion, although we've gone through the various regions, but eventually the goal is to get back to that 1 to 12,000 ratio and then kind of move that forward in time. As a reference, other states have ratios of anywhere between one store to 5,000 and one store to per 6,000 on average. There was an associated forecast expansion of revenue with this of 3%. We don't think we're seeing that quite yet. We may be seeing about a 1% increase in sales as a result. A lot of it was the timing of the stores coming on the market, but also the 3% was really an estimate at that time by legislative fiscal analysts and government fiscal analysts about what may be achieved at that. As part of that expansion, though, the legislature did give us more resources for district managers to manage process and financial analysis.
So I have another question, and I'm not sure exactly how to ask this, but I'm trying to understand the link. So for us in the state, it's important the sales keep increasing to get the taxes because it goes in our general fund. But I'm trying to understand the social side of this from the standpoint of society and cities and that. Alcoholism or drinking can be a problem in the communities and that. So I'm trying to understand when the commission makes this decision, is there any link between looking at rates of alcoholism, drunk driving? I don't know if any of that applies. I just know in communities that's a discussion. And so the convenience of alcohol being available, some would argue, could increase the opportunities for abuse of alcohol. I don't know if I asked a question or not, but.
Chair Lively, that was a very good question. The health concerns of alcohol are a concern for our agency as well, and so although we have a public safety charter, if you say so. So what we do is. We are in public safety. What we do is we focus on preventing sales to minors and preventing sales to intoxicated people. We have worked with cities and counties in the past in citing bars and restaurants in those types of problem areas. We've gone out to talk to city and county officials about any issues that they have. We also, it's not so much in the, well, that. That's not true. So we also invite public comment on any sightings. So if we get feedback from a city or county really concerned about a liquor store in a particular area or a bar and restaurant in a particular area, we take a serious look at that.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So kind of a related question. Do you see increase in sales during a recession or outside of a recession when the economy's good? I mean, is it one of those things where people are out of work and they drink more?
Chair Representative, that's a very good question. We don't necessarily increase in sales, but we don't see a decrease in sales either. So we won't say that this revenue stream is recession-proof. We did see a flattening, especially during the 2008-2009 recession. At that point, the legislature did impose a 50-cent per bottle surcharge, so to help maintain the revenues. But at this point, we have not seen the declines that we normally do. And it's been very rarely, even over the last 50 years, that we see declines in liquor sales. A lot of it being driven by the population growth in the state of Oregon. And then finally, this last slide for me, shows the results of the more recent expansion over the last 2.5 years. It shows the areas where we added new liquor stores. We have completed our regional expansion. We would go to various regions and solicit inputs and applications for new liquor stores. We have completed that process, adding about 36 new locations over the last 2.5 years. Our target was probably closer to about 40 or 50 of that. Right now, we'll be looking, we're considering what to do next, probably looking at more statewide recruitment, infill of where stores may be needed. That process is still being considered by the commission.
Back on that last, I mean, these are liquor stores that are added. 10 new locations in Harney County?
No.
In the whole region.
Am I reading that wrong?
It's in that region.
They're really drinking a lot.
It looked pretty big, didn't it? That would have been significant.
Okay, that's just in the green part.
In the region, right.
I thought, whoa.
That would have been very dramatic.
Yeah.
No, we have regions there that is the entire southern part of the state.
Okay, we're just wrapping up here. So looking forward, what to expect. There will be a phase six of a retail expansion, but we're going to take a really close look to see where there are gaps. Earlier, you heard Bill talk about we looked at population bases and our averages. However, there were some areas in the state where it was 1 to 29,000. And so we're going to just take a kind of step back, take a look, and see, did we miss some areas when we went through expansion? And so we're going to do phase six. We're going to be looking, as we move forward on retail compensation issues. One of the things that has been done in our budget bill is separating out compensation for distillery tasting rooms and liquor agents, because they are actually a little different entity, as we talked about how they're compensated. And so we'll be looking at that. There's also going to be discussion about the potential of shifting credit card fees to liquor agents, but raising the compensation for agents to take that, with the idea of keeping them whole. We'll be looking in alcohol. As I said before in the beginning, we went through marijuana implementation. We didn't do quite as many minor control checks as we had done before, or premises visits. And in addition, we're getting about 400 new licenses a year. So we're going to be going out there and stepping up our minor decoy operations and our on-premises visits in alcohol. On capital budgeting, that's always going to be an issue for us. As I mentioned before, we're a growing agency. We have space needs. We have offices throughout the state. So we're going to be taking a look at that as we continue to grow to see what makes sense. We also, within the warehouse itself, because we have retail expansion, we need room for more inventory. And so our warehouse manager is taking a very close look at that and identifying some areas where maybe we can make some improvements, shift out some inventory that's been in there before, move in some new inventory. So that's going to be a focus for us. But at some point, we may need additional buildings. And then we also have our very last phase of our roof. That we need to do on our warehouse. Probably the biggest issue that we have before us as an agency is our technology. And currently, OLCC operates on a host of outdated legacy information systems. I'm sure you've heard this from other agencies as well. But it's especially problematic for the OLCC because our revenue for the state depends on those systems working and talking together. So one of the things that you'll be seeing is we're going to be focusing on doing an integrated online alcohol licensing and renewal system. We talked about it before. We have that system for marijuana. It needs to be tweaked because we've grown outgrown our initial systems. But we need to bring, currently we do all of our alcohol licensing on hundreds of spreadsheets and thousands of pieces of paper, and we need to bring that process online, and so people can also apply and pay online as well. The same thing with electronic privilege tax. We've got an RFP out for that where we're almost in the process where we're going to have an RFP. So the folks that need to pay privilege tax can actually file their documents online and pay those taxes. One of the most important things and the critical things for the revenue for the state is replacing the four legacy systems that are outlined on the slide. And basically, these are old, as I said before, they're old segregated systems. They don't talk very much. If you want to adjust one, it causes complications in the other. And so we need to really focus on the IT that we need for purchasing and product pricing for our warehouse operations, our distribution operations, our daily sales and inventory, and agent compensation. And then, very last, well, not last, but just as important, we need to prepare that for market innovations that come forward as legislature talks about new license types. Again, those are changes to those IT systems, and so we need to be cognizant of that. But those will be discussions that move forward. At some point, we might be discussing e-commerce for distilled spirits and how that works. And then wine label regulations. You're going to have a whole host of bills in front of you this session. And so we'll work very hard as an agency to figure out should you pass those bills to implement them. And the very last thing I wanted to say is our mission itself. We as an agency really care about supporting our small businesses and what we can do to help them thrive and survive. But at the same time, we want to protect our public safety and community livability, and it's kind of a balance. And we'll continue to focus on that for both our alcohol and our marijuana programs.
Thank you. Any further questions, comments by any member? Representative Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a little bit off, and your data doesn't necessarily cover it, but I just got curious about overall per capita consumption of alcohol in the United States and looked up some statistics and was sort of surprised to see that where we stand in consumption in the United States now is far below what the peak was, which looks like it occurred in the early 80s. You have any insight for us about that trend? It went down sharply, sort of bottomed out, looked like in the mid-90s, and has been peaking back up. I'd be curious if, as you've watched this over the years, what do you think those trends represent?
Chair, Representative, that's a very interesting question. The trend, that especially at the peaks in the 80s, and this is just mostly going back to the research literature, were associated, they thought at the time, with the baby boomers hitting their 20s. And as the baby boomers left their 20s and that trend started to decrease, and now it's back starting to increase again, but as you pointed out, it's not quite as high as it was back in the 80s. A lot of the consumption of alcohol, and that would include beer, wine, and spirits, appears by people between their 20s and early 30s, and it really depends on the demographic of the population where they were in that point in time. And that's one of the theories out there. Other than that, right now, we have an aging population. We have a population about 78% of it's over 21. Oregon is one of those states where a larger percentage of the population does drink relative to other states, such as Utah, for example. It's one of those trends that has puzzled researchers over the years as well. So,
thank you. That's interesting.
Any other questions or comments? Looks like we're good to go. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Per capita consumption.
So I'll close the informational hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2523. Give us a summary of the bill as our good representative comes forward to testify.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2523 allows Oregon Liquor Control Commission agents and distillery retail outlet agents to deliver distilled liquor to consumers subject to commission rules and delivery requirements.
Okay, welcome.
Okay, welcome. Thank you. Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Bonham and Fahey. For the record, I'm my State Representative Margaret Doherty from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. I'm here today to discuss House Bill 2523, which would help modernize how alcohol is delivered in the state of Oregon. Before I jump into the legislation, I want to take a few minutes to tell you what is currently permitted and then discuss how this bill would improve our current system. Today, an individual can walk into an OLCC-appointed agent retail location, purchase a distilled spirit product from that location, and request it be shipped directly to their door on the same day. This shipment must be achieved by an OLCC-approved for-hire carrier. More often than not, it's a UPS or FedEx type of shipper. However, there is no requirement that the shipping entity accomplish age verification, assess intoxication, or do many of the other things that are required for the shipping of other types of products that are also governed by the OLCC, like marijuana. It is obviously an oversight that we can easily address. In fact, HB 2523 would achieve this. With this bill and with the Dash 1 amendments, which are up on OLIS now, it also aims to modernize how consumers access distilled spirits through a secure delivery process. The amendment before you would allow for, one, the ordering of distilled spirit products to be accomplished online, mirroring regulations for grocery stores, convenience stores, breweries, and wineries for beer, wine, and cider. Two, the ability of an OLCC-appointed retail agent to accomplish delivery via a third party who is a licensed courier through the OLCC under this new licensure. And three, authority for the OLCC to impose sanction on the holder of the carrier or the courier license would be created under this legislation. The last piece is important because under the current statute, the OLCC can only hire or prohibit an entity currently defined as a for-hire carrier for shipping. Additionally, today, there is no fee currently assessed to allow for a for-hire carrier. Creating a licensure would not only empower further enforcement and improve parameters of delivery, but it also creates a fee for the service. Throughout my work in the legislature, I've learned that there are many nuances to alcohol delivery currently, so let me provide you an example of how this would work. So let's say there's a business who specializes in currently shipping to a consumer, and for our purposes today, we're going to call it Nozama. So Nozama, after obtaining OLCC courier license, would be permitted to pick up distilled spirit products directly from an OLCC-appointed retailer that the consumer has ordered online. They would deliver directly to the consumer in Oregon after verifying age and meeting all other important parameters like assessing intoxication, record keeping, et cetera. Nozama, as a licensed courier, would be able to be sanctioned and would also pay a fee for obtaining the license. In this instance, this is beneficial to Nozama because they are able to deliver a product that they would have been prohibited from previously. The OLCC-appointed retailer is able to easily meet the need for delivery for consumers, and the delivery process is modernized. A good sideboards are put on for accountability. And to me, this is something that is just in this day and age where we have everything delivered to our houses. I think it's another tool that the OLCC agents can use to market their products. To me, this is really a common sense bill that modernizes what and how consumers in Oregon are available to have distilled spirits delivered. I have been and continue to work with stakeholders on this bill to address any concerns, and imagine we will continue to work through it with other questions. One of the things that the liquor store in downtown Tigard, and there are some apartments down there, we have somebody who always drives his little cart, his little motorized cart to the liquor store. Now, he can't quite get it into the liquor store, but they go through and they get him in far enough that he's able to purchase liquor. But those are the sort of people that might avail themselves of these services. So with that, I'll pause here, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
So what questions do members have for the representative? Representative Drazen.
Just really quickly, thank you, Representative Doherty. I have a quick question. What did you call your pretend group again?
The person, the what?
The Zama?
Nozama.
Nozama.
Amazon backwards.
With those...
That's a trick, then. I'll look at Nozama and figure it out.
Have to have alcohol service permits just to be in, just to be confident that they could recognize if someone was already intoxicated, that they weren't telling
people. Well, that would be something, since they would have to do that, that I'm, and I'm making assumptions here through the rulemaking process, that they would go through the same process that servers go through to get a server's permit.
Thank you.
Other questions for the representative? Representative McEwen, please.
Representative, does that, is the type of vehicle called out in this bill? Does it have to be a car?
No, there's nothing in here that talks about the type of vehicle that it would be.
Could be a bicycle, could be a golf cart, could be...
But that would be something that would be decided in, well, in King City would have golf carts.
That's what I'm thinking.
But I think that that would be something that would be made up in rules. And if it's one of those things, to have it in the legislation, but there is no specificity as to what sort of vehicle it is.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Representative Wallen.
Or delivery. Yeah.
Thank you. I was on the city council in Medford when we agreed to allow the delivery of marijuana, mm-hmm. but the state laws on that are much stricter. They do, that, not the, I do think they do control the kind of vehicle. You have to have a locked box and a lot of other things. So would you think, so two questions. One, do you think they should be the same as each other? And if so, do you think that the liquor should be more controlled like marijuana, or the marijuana should be less controlled like this particular bill is for
well,
liquor?
Well, on this, and thank you very much, Representative Wallen, Chair Lively, is that those are things that are made in the rules, but I think it is important to have very strict rules on something like this. I can see why you'd have a lockbox in a marijuana delivery, and it may be the same sort of thing. If it would be maybe a little more difficult since liquor's a little larger, but to go through and limit how much you can order, and you know, and that kind of thing, I think that that's extremely reasonable to ask.
Thank you.
So,
any other questions? Very good. Thank you for bringing the bill. So I have one person who's signed up to speak, Mike Fries. Please come forward, state your name for the record, provide your testimony.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I think you've had a chance to hear a lot from OLCC and Representative Doherty. We haven't had a chance to review the Dash One amendment, but we've had a great opportunity to work with her, and we think that this that the bill through the Dash One is probably a much improved. So some of you may be wondering why the beer and wine distributors are interested in this, and that's because we do have members that are, they either distribute distilled spirits in other states or they import them into Oregon. It's also important to note that the safety and access to alcohol is really important to beer, well, to the entire alcohol industry. And this may be an opportunity also to look at what the way that we do home shipments or home deliveries of beer and wine as well. So while this bill doesn't address that, and I think we've talked some with Representative Doherty about that, and the relating to clause is very narrow, but it's certainly something that we want to explore and work with the OLCC and see if this really is an opportunity to have some consistency across the industry to make sure that, you know, children aren't getting access to alcohol at home, and that we do have safe and secure deliveries. So we will continue to work with Representative Doherty and anybody else that has an interest in the subject. And once we have a chance to review the Dash Ones, I looked at it on my phone based on a very, very quick review. It looked fine. But if we do see any potential issues, we will be sure to raise them to you, Mr. Chair. With that, happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mike? Didn't look like it. Thanks for testifying. So I have nobody else who signed up for this measure. Is there anybody else right now that would like to offer testimony in House Bill 2523? Okay, hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2523. Members, are there any other items of business that we need to address today, concerns? Didn't look like it?
Okay.
We'll adjourn.
Oh, that's quick. Okay.